Hi, I'm Karin Zessis of ASCOA Online. It's September, and that means Mexico observes its Independence Day on the 16th. In the capital's massive plaza, or Zócalo, soldiers marched to commemorate the event. This year, the marching follows a rather symbolic development. At the beginning of the month, the president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, known as AMLO, introduced a reform to transfer the 110,000-strong National Guard from civilian to military command.
¡Viva México! ¡Viva México!
Both houses of Congress, where his coalition holds the most seats, approved it within days and right in time for the patriotic holiday. But the reform is not without controversy, given that the National Guard is charged with policing in Mexico's ongoing bloody battle against organized crime. All of this comes as AMLO seeks to showcase his accomplishments heading into the last 2 years of his presidency, and as the 2024 electoral race is already heating up.
He himself is going to be, you know, a force to reckon with for whoever the next president is. I think that's one of the most important and significant legacies he has built during his term.
That's political analyst Carlos Bravo Regidor, who writes for Reforma and Expansión Política and contributes to a number of outlets such as Foro TV and Gato Pardo. In this episode, I spoke with him about Mexico's deepening militarization and the political panorama as the competition to replace López Obrador picks up pace. Before we get started, I also want to mention that you may notice Latin America in Focus has a refreshed look. We're excited to bring you new episodes, and we encourage you to share and subscribe. Learn more at as-coa.org/podcast.
You're listening to Latin America in Focus.
Latinoamérica en Foco.
América Latina en Foco.
A podcast by America Society, Council of the Americas, on politics, economics, and culture in the region.
Thank you so much, Carlos, for being with me today. It's such a pleasure to have you on. So September is a sort of a momentous time of year always in Mexico. It starts with the president giving his informe, which is sort of equivalent to a U.S. State of the Union. And it's this time of Fiestas Patrias, Independence Day.
Mexicanos! Viva la Independencia!
And it's also symbolically considered earthquake season.
Another thing important in September is not only earthquake season, but the legislative session starts as well.
Yes, absolutely. Very good point for the question I'm going to ask. Now you can make the case that the political earthquake this year involves the military. And as the country faces ongoing problems with violence and rule of law, López Obrador has taken steps to extend and expand the role of the military in public security in Mexico. The military has been engaged in this offensive against organized crime for 15 years. And in recent days, AMLO was reminded that when he was campaigning, he promised to send the military back to the barracks. Just in recent days, he said, "I've had a change of opinion." Now he's seeking to keep the military in the streets beyond the end of his presidency in 2024. Can you tell us how AMLO's relationship with the military has changed and why is it gaining prominence in Mexico?
Of course. Well, first, let me say that indeed, yes, he has explained this as a change of opinion, because, you know, he wasn't aware, or he wasn't made aware, of how bad the situation was. So when he was informed of the details of how rooted organized crime was in the territory, he has said he changed his mind. But on the other hand, we have some pretty serious evidence on WikiLeaks that he had a meeting with an American ambassador, if I remember correctly, I think it was in 2005, where he laid out his plan in case he won the presidency. And his plan was exactly what he did once he won 12 years after. Mm-hmm. So he was sort of preaching to the choir of demilitarization when he was a candidate. But in that WikiLeaks cable, we actually can say that, well, maybe he didn't change his mind, but this was what he was planning to do all along. Having said that, it has been surprising, because not only has he continued the pattern of giving the military more responsibilities in matters of public security, he has also defunded the police. There was always this sort of horizon in which, you know, since Felipe Calderón took the decision of bringing the military in to combat organized crime, there was always this notion that this was a temporary, an exceptional, an extraordinary measure, and that eventually the army was going to go back to the barracks and the police will take care of things. Both Calderón and Peña Nieto invested in police training, in police technology, you know, sort of, you know, giving credence to this notion that, you know, we didn't want the army to be out forever and ever, that eventually, you know, we would have the police forces ready and capable of tackling organized crime, and the army was going to go back to the barracks. With López Obrador, what has happened is he has sort of shattered that horizon. He has not invested in police. He actually, you know, closed down the federal police office. He has given the military not only more control than previous presidents, but what he's actually trying to do is to normalize the exception, so to speak, to say, this is what we're going to do for good. Mm-hmm. And there's no turning back. And the second thing that has been very surprising is how he has given the military a lot more tasks than just public security. He has, you know, given them the mission of building public infrastructure, being in charge of the distribution of medicines, for instance, or of oil or gas, or, you know, even he has put the military, you know, in a position of having to carry out migration control tasks as well. So the military has become multifunctional, so to speak, in matters that are very foreign to their nature or their actual function. And this is, you know, surprising, because a president that won with such a landslide, with an absolute democratic majority that no Mexican president in the history of democracy had won, why would he have to rely so much on the military? He has certainly managed to bring the military in a move that is also inconsistent in a way with his leftist profile. There are exceptions to this, of course, in the history of Latin America. But in generally, when we think of governments that ally themselves with the military or that bring the military in, they tend to be right-wing governments, no left-wing governments, as López Obrador is supposed to be. And, you know, he has said so himself, that bringing the military in will help him, helps his project, his vision for Mexico, to become irreversible. Mm-hmm. And this, of course, is a challenge to democracy. What if, you know, another party wins in 2024 and has a different policy and wants to take all of these tasks and responsibilities away from the army? The thing with that is, it's very easy to give things to the army. It's very hard to take them back. So this, mm-hmm. in a way, is placing a very strong restriction on whoever becomes president next.
We did a podcast when AMLO was in his first 100 days in office. Let's just say a lot has happened since then. So we're 4 years in. This was the fourth informe that AMLO delivered. And in the conjunction with the State of the Union, we see him talking about these major infrastructure projects, the airport, and some of these kinds of big legacy projects. We talked in that episode about AMLO's desire to build a legacy and place himself in history with his fourth transformation. How do you see AMLO's efforts toward legacy building now, 4 years in?
In material terms, in terms of public infrastructure, whether it is the alternative airport, the refinery, the train in the Yucatan Peninsula, and things like that. He's building them, certainly.
El aeropuerto Felipe Ángeles se construyó en 2 años y medio. Nos ahorramos 100 mil millones de pesos. Es el mejor aeropuerto de América Latina.
But, one of them is already operating, which is the alternative airport. But the number of flights, the activity-wise, it's a failed airport. I mean, airports in Ciudad Obregón or in Tapachula have more flights than this new airport in Mexico City. Actually, the other day in the news, not that long ago, there was this number that there are more buses, going out of that airport than actual airplanes. So it's failed. It's failed so far because, the airport was built, but all the accessibility to the airport is still to be built, but they already inaugurated it nonetheless. I think he needed a win in that regard, and he just managed to inaugurate it when it's not ready yet. And we don't know when it's going to be ready. It's farther away from the places in Mexico City where, the people that take most airplanes live in. So it doesn't seem that it's going to work well. And apart from that, we have the refinery, which is a very counterintuitive thing to do in a moment where, green energies and renewables are receiving such a big push, particularly from the United States. And, the Tren Maya has been a mess. It's an ecological disaster. This has been, all over the news. But he has been very stubborn and that he wants to build it. So legacy-wise, in that material sense, I think he's going to end up delivering very poor results. He's going to be able to say, mission accomplished. There's a train, there's a refinery, there's an airport, right? But, if they work, if they become viable, how much of a strong impact are they going to have in the economy, employment creation, so on and so forth? I think the prospects are not very good. Nevertheless, what AMLO has done in terms of legacy building, I think his strong point is it's in another dimension, so to speak. Economic growth is the lowest it has been in 30 years or so. The bar was not that high. Average growth in Mexico for the last decades was around 2%. But he has managed not to be punished, whether, through his party in the elections that have taken place, the midterm election or state elections, and also in terms of his popularity. It has fallen, of course, from the rooftop that it started on. But now he has pretty consistently been stable at around the high 50s, low 60s, which is, a level of high popularity for Mexican presidents. So what's interesting is he has somehow been able to suspend for the Mexican public to make him responsible for his government's failures. And in the polls, you can see, it's not that people don't know. People are very, disapproving of his results in terms of crime, violence. People are not happy with corruption. But, in general, the approval rate of him is high. But the approval rate of his government is not that high, or is mixed. But that somehow doesn't translate. So, López Obrador won with a big majority, and everything seems to indicate that that majority is not as big, but it's still significant, and that they are willing to go along with him. And I think that legacy will survive to the point where AMLO's charismatic leadership or popularity is going to become, using a term I've used previously, a real factor of power after presidential succession. He himself is going to be, you know, a force to reckon with for whoever the next president is. I think that's one of the most important and significant legacies he has built during his term.
Mm-hmm. About that political capital, because that's what it is. It's almost, his approval ratings almost feel like money in the bank for his political party, Morena. Morena has become the dominant political party in basically less than a decade. It's quite incredible when you look at it. It holds 2/3 of the governorships. Its coalition holds the largest number of seats in Congress. It's snapped up local legislatures and local seats as well. And all of this comes as we head toward this next election. And it's led many to ask whether Morena is the new PRI. For those who don't focus on Mexico as much, was the political party that dominated Mexican politics throughout most of the 20th century and has since crumbled to a great degree. And so many ask, has Morena become the new PRI? What do you think?
Well, I think the answer is going to be frustrating, but at the same time, it's the best I can come up with. It depends on what we mean by PRI. I mean, I think there are a number of elements that support that interpretation. Not the lesser important of them is the fact that the growth of Morena is, well, pretty much unexplainable without the collapse of the PRI. In a lot of these places where Morena has won, there has been basically been a migration of voters, but also of politicians and of political machines from the PRI to Morena. So in that way, it's not that they're the new PRI. They're the same PRI under a different name. It's also, you know, the analogy holds in terms of its capacity to become the place where political entrepreneurs want to be, because it's the place that promises a more certain political future. It's the party that holds more positions, more power, that seems to be more popular. Right now, still, most of the electorate still think of change when they hear about Morena or López Obrador. Mm. And the credibility of the other parties is very low. They're still being punished because of what happened during the Peña Nieto administration or before. So yes, Morena has become the new PRI in a way in which, you know, the PRI used to be the only game in town, you know, before the transition to democracy. And now Mexico is still a democracy, although I think it's undergoing a process of democratic erosion or of democratic backsliding, but it is still a democracy. And Morena is nonetheless becoming, if not the only, you know, the largest game in town. Now, I don't think it's like the old PRI, because the old PRI, as corrupt as it was, you know, created certain institutions. And it was a party whose priority used to be stability, political stability. It was corrupt, it was authoritarian, but, you know, it created stability and created institutions. And none of this seemed to be features of López Obradorismo. López Obrador has, you know, eroded institutions, captured them, canceled them. His politics tend to be very deliberately disruptive of any, you know, stability that we used to have in regards to electoral processes, in regards to the relationship with the United States. In so many instances, he has been a destabilizer in chief, so to speak, that, you know, I have a hard time thinking of him or of his coalition as if they were like the PRI. So that's why I said it depends on what you focus on for that analogy to make sense or not. Maybe, you know, I would like to finish with the fact that in electoral terms, López Obrador has become a very active president. He's really, you know, intervening in electoral processes through his communication platform, but also his government. I mean, his political appointees are participating in campaigns, are supporting candidates. You know, INE is, you know, running around like a headless chicken trying to stop people from doing this, but it's not succeeding. So in that regard, you might say, well, it's like the old PRI, you know, where the separation between government and party is very porous to non-existent.
And you talked a little bit about how we're already seeing this campaigning going on. We have what in Mexico is called the corcholatas, which is a bit hard to translate into English, the mindset of it. The idea is that they're like bottle caps, and AMLO himself said that he's popping off these corcholatas, these bottle caps that are competing.
Yo soy el destapador y mi corcholata favorita va a ser la del pueblo.
And it feels a little bit like we're watching more a race between candidates in Morena than overall, because we see the Mexico City mayor, Claudia Sheinbaum, and Marcelo Ebrard, the foreign minister. We're seeing these prominent names almost competing, going out, appearing at different events around the country, almost like they're in campaign mode. We know that AMLO likes to be in campaign mode, and we're seeing it going on with these corcholatas. We see it in the polls too. It's the Morenistas that are leading the polls. It doesn't look good for the opposition right now, but there are 2 years to go before this election. What would it take for the opposition to win in 2024?
That's a great question. I think the most important thing for the opposition to become electorally viable is going to be for the López Obradorista coalition to split. With a unified López Obradorista coalition, with a disciplined party rallying behind whoever becomes the candidate, I think it would be very hard for the opposition to defeat Morena in the next elections. Of course, there are signs of tensions within Morena, and the president himself sort of announced the start of the electoral season very early on, almost 3 years before it happened, you know, right after the midterms were over. You know, he said, well, you know, it's legitimate for these people to have aspirations, to have an ambition, and I am not going to interfere with that. They have their public responsibilities. I just ask them, you know, to fulfill them, but they are free to pursue their interest in the candidacy of Morena to the presidency. In a way, that was a self-inflicted wound, because he was sort of becoming a lame duck by the middle of his term. And this, of course, places, you know, a bullseye, particularly in Claudia Sheinbaum's back, because he has not been discreet in the fact that she is his favorite. And this creates all sorts of tensions within the party, in a party that is particularly uninstitutionalized in terms of its rules, its procedures. The most important thing, in terms of its capacity to discipline the losers. And all of the people that are not with Sheinbaum are starting to get angry with the president. And this is creating the impression that the succession process is not going to be a smooth process. In terms of the opposition, you know, becoming viable, but also in terms of Morena, of the president, of all these corcholatas or bottle caps. The second problem with the opposition is that, as I said previously, they are still paying the price of the discredit of the, you know, traditional political class, of the traditional party system. And the people on top of the parties still represent that. And I think in a way they are behaving not necessarily, you know, towards trying to win or to become really competitive, but in terms of political survival. So their policy is not, let's find the most competitive and attractive candidate to defeat Morena, is let's find a way for us to keep control of the party even if we lose. And that's a great advantage to Morena. And given how improbable it seems that the opposition is going to become competitive, this is only, you know, a self-fulfilling logic. Because they say, we're not going to win anyway. So why risk it? Let's just, you know, play it safe and occupy all the spaces we can. Not only in regards to their competitors, but also within, you know, what John Deaton used to call the insider baseball of each party. The fraction of the party that has power wants to keep it, you know, against all the other factions or other currents within those parties. And the third thing is, you know, there was this idea that the opposition was going to go together in an alliance with a single candidate and a single program. And that has been destroyed by the fact that, you know, the leader of the PRI is signaling very clearly that he is willing to support the president in his effort to keep the Guardia Nacional, this military body with allegedly police functions that was created at the beginning of the term. He's willing to support the Guardia Nacional, you know, to be out in the streets. And that has caused for the PAN and the PRD leadership to say that if the PRI continues down this path, they are breaking away from the accords they have to, you know, to run together in 2024. So the prospects are very good for Morena.
Yeah. It's been great getting to talk to you, and I could keep asking you questions, and I'm going to fit in one last quick one.
Okay. Go ahead.
So the last time I had you on as a guest at this 100-day mark, I asked you what had surprised you most about AMLO's first 100 days. And this is what you said. I didn't expect his administration to be as right-wing as it's been. Now, a lot has happened. We're 4 years into this. What would you say now, looking back, has been the biggest surprise for you about AMLO's presidency?
Well, that surprise I told you about is still valid. It's still surprising. But I think by now, my most important surprise has not to do with him or his government, but with the Mexican population. How undemanding, how tolerant, and how supportive it has been to AMLO, in spite of all his failures, in spite of all his, turnarounds, and in spite of all the deaths that have accumulated, you know, not only related to violence, we're still at a very high level. It is true that homicides have not, you know, grown that much since AMLO became president. They have stayed more or less in the same levels, an all-time high. Disappearances are at an all-time high. Disappearances, you know, in average for AMLO are three times the disappearances we had under Felipe Calderón. And somehow this, it's a bit unexplainable how a population that was so fed up, so demanding with other presidents has become so, I don't have a, you know, this is probably the best word I can come up with, so soggy in its political attitude towards AMLO. Mm-hmm. That's what surprises me more. 4 years after. Mm-hmm. You were not expecting that, right?
No, I completely hear what you're saying. And it's a very heavy thing. And as we know, Mexico marked 100,000 disappearances this summer, which is was a very hard toll to see. We know that it means a lot of families searching for their loved ones. And it's very painful. So it's a difficult, painful answer.
I need to add all the deaths, all the COVID-related deaths as well. He has not had to pay a political price for that. I just, it's a very bitter pill to swallow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a very, very heavy thing to end on, but it's a really interesting observation. So I very much appreciate your time today. We'll put a link to the first podcast in the podcast notes. And I also encourage everyone to, para los que hablan español, to listen to Carlos's podcasts and read his commentary. It's always interesting and enlightening. Thank you so much for being with me today.
No, thank you, Karen. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. Thank you for listening. I'm your host, Karin Zesis. This podcast was produced by our executive producer, Luisa Leme. We encourage you to check the podcast notes for relevant links to learn more. The music in this podcast is Cantos de México by composer Carlos Chávez, performed for America Society by Orquesta Pasatono. For more about upcoming concerts, visit musicoftheamericas.org. We hope you enjoyed this episode. You can help us spread the word. Give us 5 stars, write a review, share, and subscribe at Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.